session number 29956, reel 4.
The concept of a just
had a humanitarian reason. That is how I would have put it, that it was a war in which humanity was involved, and there was a reason on the basis of humanity, not of acquiring land. I was at least in my mind aware of the difference between helping people and acquiring additional land. Empire, I really began that during World War One. That the empire became a disreputable word for me. Why one country dominating so many other countries? That I thought morally wrong. Mm. But of course, if you were attacked, I felt then you had a right to.
So you weren't completely pacifist at that time?
No.
No. Have you changed since then?
Yes, I have, partly because I can think of no reason why wars cannot be avoided. Why talk should not replace killing. I would like someone to explain to me what killing achieves that talking doesn't or can't achieve. Because finally, that's what's going to happen. Now we're trying to involve other countries in the Middle East, don't we, to help settle the Iraq situation. So why couldn't this have happened? Or, if one wants to be honest, why did we give Saddam Hussein the means to acquire the arms? You see, if you're really honest and go back to the origins, who in fact gave Saddam the wherewithal to start acquiring arms? Because we, or the US, or both of us, were wanting to have allies against those we thought were our enemies when 10 years ago, when the build-up of Saddam began. More than that, because I remember when I was still a member of the IOP and the Baathists taking power. There wasn't a Saddam, but the organisation existed when I was still in the IOP.
This is very interesting, you know, because being a member of the ILP in this sort of interwar period, the 1920s and 30s, there was this big debate, wasn't there, about between pacifism and those who wanted to rearm, the people who were for disarmament.
Yes.
Were you involved with that at all?
Yes, because that was why we left the ILP. Italy had attacked Abyssinia, and what's the League of Nations, a defunct body by that? No time. That's where my history is at fault. I cannot recall when the League of Nations was no longer existed.
It was certainly there in the 30s, you know, up until the Second World War, but it wasn't really taking, as you've explained, there was very little power, it didn't have, there were sanctions, I think, against Abyssinia, but very weak ones, weren't they?
And I remember there was a resolution that was put to the annual general conference of the ILP, which was not accepted. you know, the majority voted against a small group which had developed inside the ILP, calling itself the Revolutionary Policy Committee.
Were you part of that?
Yes.
You supported that?
Now, I'm trying to remember what our stance was on rearming or passive resistance, and I cannot remember.
Oh, don't worry, but you're remembering so much that...
Partly because by that time the fascist menace was so great. You see, Hitler came to power in 1933. So we were aware of the danger of fascism by 35, when the Spanish Civil War started. And I certainly wasn't a pacifist then, because I cheered my friends who joined the International Brigade and went to fight in Spain, many of whom were my personal friends. I cried when John Cornforth killed Ralph Fox. And I supported the IB and what it was it was defending us by fighting in Spain. And the war against fascism.
Were you married then, Hetty?
Pardon?
Were you married then?
Oh, yes, I married in 1932.
And was your husband, you know, did you agree on these things?
Oh, yes, because he had joined the labour movement in 1926 as a result of the miners' lockout. Actually, I took him his membership card. That's how I first saw him. And he joined the Hackney ILP. So really, we were in partnership with our membership of the ILP. I used to tell him about the 1922 election and the 1924 election and the first Labour government, and he was very disappointed that they hadn't achieved more in 1924. But of course, it was a minority government. The Liberals and the Tories voted together all the time to obstruct what the Labour Party in 24 was trying to achieve. And then 26, the miners' lockout, Reg was absolutely convinced that the miners were absolutely right to resist what the mine owners were attempting to do, add an hour to their day of work and deduct a penny off the hour payment. They were paid by the hour, and they wanted to reduce the hourly payment by a penny and to add an hour to the working day, although statistics show that most of the accidents that occurred down the mine occurred during that last period of work. So adding another hour onto the working day meant even more accidents and unnecessary deaths in the mines. And that was all 26. 27, 28 was when Anita and I left home. And that was enabled me finally to marry Reg, because Reg wasn't Jewish.
Yes, and that was in 19... You married him in what date? 32?
Well, I left with my sister.
Yeah. When did you marry Reg?
1932.
Oh, yes, that's what I thought. I've got down. Yes,
32. 33, Hitler came to power. So we were well aware in Hackney there was a very strong fascist element in Hackney.
It was there.
And the public house at the end of our road, if you recall, I referred to the church at one end and the public house at the other. The Ridley Arms was the local meeting place for fascists, and my father had to pass that every day to get the tram or bus to his business. And my father didn't know the word fear. He would stop if, you know, we were quite sure that if a fascist approached him aggressively, he would say, "What have I done to hurt you? Why do you want to hurt me?" You know, and to try and bring a rational element into that. But, you know, these people weren't rational. And Reg and I had taken part in Table Street.
Really? Yes, you would.
Oh, yes, we were members of the Communist Party by then, 1935. There was a mass exodus from the IOP, and I would think 80% of the London membership joined the Communist Party, because they hadn't accepted our resolution on fascism. The IOP was taking a similar attitude to the Labour Party, that we should ignore the fascists, not attend their meetings. I never had the courage to go, but I know people that did, and if they asked questions, if they heckled the speaker, they were just bodily lifted and thrown out. There was a big fascist meeting held at Olympia, and a future brother-in-law of mine, that's exactly what happened to him. He was a student at Sheffield University and had come down to demonstrate against the anti-Semitism of the fascists, and he was lifted bodily and taken out and thrown down steps, and there were communists selling or attempting to sell the paper, Daily Worker, outside, and they helped him to his feet and gave him first aid and so on. He had no political allegiance. That meeting politicized him, and he joined the Communist Party without knowing anything about it, except that these were communists who'd helped him and bandaged him and so on.
So how about Cable Street? Were you there at the famous event, or infamous event?
We have been members of the Communist Party for about 6 months by the time Cable Street occurred, and Reg had been given the job of holding the fort in Stepney if the fascists broke through at Gardner's Corner. They were going on a route along Whitechapel, and he had to be holding a meeting there to try and stop them there, to prevent them marching further into the Jewish quarter. So we, by that time, I had a daughter of 2 years old too, but I'd taken her to my parents. I wouldn't expose her. I think there were some children that were brought to Cable Street. We went early to Gardner's Corner because I wanted to see what was going on before the march was due. So I saw Mosley, who had been a member of the IOP and had left because he didn't suddenly become its leading member, and started the new party, and that didn't take off. So then suddenly he became a Hitler devotee and was a fully fledged fascist. So there was Mosley standing in military uniform up here, lovely polished gaiters and beautiful kid gloves. I was as near to him as I am to you, talking to the chief of Met Police, and they were like twin brothers, quite a different chief Met to the ones we've had recently. And the police force were quite different to the police force on the anti-Iraq war. We had a doctor who was weaving in and out of the crowds gathering, because there was obviously a build-up. Mosley and the Met chief were in cohorts about how Mosley could break through for his march. And equally, our comrade, the medical man, who looked as if he might be one of them, was getting information as to what was being planned, if they couldn't go down this way, whether they could go down that way. And meantime, the dockers, communists, and the ordinary people of the East End of London were putting up their barricades to prevent the fascists marching. Well, Reg and I had to leave Gardener's Corner to take the platform to where we were told to stand it, and there was Reg talking to maybe half a dozen old Jews or old dockers that were too old really to take active part, and waiting for what might happen. How long that took, I really do not know. And I wasn't there when the actual scuffle took place in Cable Street, because, as I say, I was doing what I'd been instructed to do. And then we heard this roar, sort of a murmur that grew and grew and grew, but you couldn't distinguish what was being said. I wrote about this in my autobiography. And then suddenly there were people coming towards us, and we didn't know, is that the fascists marching or who is it? And I couldn't hear the slogan, and they were shouting the slogan of the Spanish Civil War, "Non pasarán," they shall not pass. And we were trying to distinguish what it was, and we couldn't hear clearly enough. And then we heard other people shouting, "They did not pass, they did," in English. So Reg and I, we looked at each other, and then we recognised several people coming towards us and knew they were our people, and that we'd won.
So was that important, it's called the Battle of Cable Street, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's called the Battle of Cable Street, isn't
it? Because that's one of the turnings that led Lehman Street, Cable Street, Whitechapel High Street, Commercial Road. They all met at my 100th birthday film that was done of me, and I was talking about these very things. We went with the photographer, and of course there's no such thing as gardener, G-A-R-D-I-N-E-R. Now, there must somewhere be some photographs of that period, of that actual event. I'm quite sure Hugh Faulkner is the doctor's name. He started the medical group practice, which is in Bloomsbury. Hugh Faulkner, who was the communist doctor weaving in and out of the fascist as they were grouping, that got the information about where they were trying to break through. And he took part in the Table Street. Phil Piratin, who became a communist MP in 45, was leading the Jewish people from the East End. Phil Piratin was actually at the siege of the struggle. I gather that there was some fisticuffs. But in fact, it was the numbers of the opposition. And I think that some of the fascists had already imbibed drink. Well, not... somebody told me that. I didn't see it, but that some were already, tipsy.
But I think Winston Churchill was involved in Cable Street, wasn't he?
No, not to my knowledge. Churchill was at the time of the general strike.
Yes,
that followed the miners' lockout.
I wondered if he was sort of involved in the. Let it go, ahead.
He may have been in the chief of police, may have been in touch with him. But after all, in 1935, Winston Churchill no special role then. He was not the winner of the war in 1935. Who would have been the Member of Parliament then?
Yes,
our Prime Minister, I mean.
Yes, I've got a feeling at that time that are we not talking of Baldwin? Would this not have been Baldwin's time?
Who?
Baldwin.
Yes.
But Winston Baldwin at
the time of the general strike.
Yeah.
But and who took then over was, from Baldwin?
There was the.
Was it to break the general strike?
Yes.
He came out, he had a newspaper printed, the British Gazette. And the printers, the working class printers that were printing, had been printing the communist paper, then brought out the. What was our paper called then? I wasn't. In the party in 1926.
Mm-hmm.
Reg had a copy every day. The British Worker or some word like that. That was the paper brought out on behalf of the strike. Mm-hmm. I know, Reg, and then. Sometime in the 50s or 60s, an exhibition was mounted of the about the general strike, and Reg was asked to loan all his copies because he had every day of the 9 days, 10 days. And he never got them back. But the London Library must have copies of them.
Oh, yes, there will definitely be copies in the London
Library. And I would have thought...